Okay, so welcome to lecture four. So this is yet another aspect that is a little bit different between this semester and the previous semesters. For those of you who have listened to some of the previous lectures, we are taking a slightly slower pace, and I'm actually taking you through some of the specifics so that I'm assuming a little less previous knowledge about computer architecture and some of the more lower level programming skills, just so that I can help some of you from other disciplines and so on to actually ease a little bit better into the material. So this time I'm going to take you through the threads, okay, then how the threading actually works, and then take you through a couple of the exercises. So until you start to actually think about these things in a more practical way, oftentimes it makes sense, but it may not really have sunk in. So this is yet another aspect that David and I added to make sure that you get a really solid footing before you go into the material. The first slide is just a quick review. We already talked about this last time. So it's just thread blocks, the concept of thread blocks, and just here I'm showing this slide here to as a reminder that we're kind of going more into the thread blocks. And we also talk about the thread, the transparent scalability, and so this is just yet another reminder. The thread blocks are the unit of work assignment, okay, and only the threads within the blocks are guaranteed to have some kind of synchronized behavior, and also have some efficient way of sharing data. And all the blocks will be assigned on a arbitrary basis to execute for execution. Okay, you cannot assume any relative timing between the thread blocks, okay? So so now let's go into kind of the architecture aspect. We used this slide in lecture two. It shows a kind of a block diagram for the G80. And the G280, as I mentioned, is looks exactly like this, but it will have 30 of those, rather than 16 of these SMPs organized into 8 kind of a dual SMP units, you will see 30 of those organized into something like 15. Okay, so it's not really different, and it's actually the beauty of this whole architecture. Essentially they can just keep scaling these things and keep adding memory interfaces. And there are 6 memory interfaces in this picture, and there are more of those in 280. But the scaling, the way they scale up the configuration of these chips is quite straightforward, at least at a conceptual level. Now, we talked about having the thread execution manager on top that will assign these thread blocks, right? Assign these thread blocks into each of these SMPs. So every 8 of these little tiles form the SMP, and that's going to be the focus of the discussion in the next few slides, okay? These 8 units, the 8 little tiles in the picture will form the unit of hardware execution. Every time there is a piece of work, every time there is a thread block that will be executed, it goes to one of those 8 little tile units, okay? And that, the thread block will be entirely executed in one of these units until it's done. Okay, so let's go into a little bit more detail here. So on slide 5, I show one of those 8 units, right? One of those 8, what I call the building blocks, and half of each is, each half is one streaming multiprocessor, right? And each half of this picture is one of those 8 tile units that will execute the thread blocks, okay?
So how is this done? These threads are really, you know what, the blocks are really assigned into, you know what, whenever there is any kind of available you know, execution resource in one of the SMPs, the a thread block will be picked and assigned into one of them. And you can assign up to 8 thread blocks into each of these SMPs, okay? So, you know what, that's one of the first limitations. You cannot have more than 8 thread blocks in each SMP, okay? No matter how small these blocks are, you cannot assign more than 8, okay? And that has to do with the hardware resources needed to keep track of the progress of these thread blocks. There are only 8 of those, okay? That's what it is. And the 8 blocks is not necessarily the only constraint. The another important constraint is that each SM can take up to 768 threads total. Okay, so you know, keep in mind the size of the thread blocks is variable, right? You can define bigger thread blocks or smaller thread blocks, but up to 8 of them could go into a SMP, and if you add up all the threads among all the thread blocks assigned to one SMP, there cannot be more than 768 threads total. So that's another limitation that has to do with the hardware resources that are needed in order to track the progress of each thread, right? And they're not necessarily the same. These two hardware resources, the block level and the thread level, are not necessarily the same. So if we take that, you know, into a little bit more kind of a you know, practical view, you could have, let's say, 256 threads in a block. Yes.
But that means that you cannot have more than 760 threads in concurrent, but I can actually assign like 1,000 threads, but they will not run. So my question is, why if I assign more than 700?
Okay. So let me get back to that point in a couple minutes, because you know, I'll be able to answer it a little better, you know, after I give you a little more detail. So you could have a thread block that contain, you can define the thread blocks to contain 256 threads. In the matrix multiplication example, if you have 16 by 16, that's 256 threads, okay? And if you have 8 by 8, that's 64 threads per block, right? So, you know, let's say if we decided to have 256 threads per block, the limitation now means that you can have up to 3 blocks, because you can only have 768 threads. And if you divide 668 threads by 256 per block, you end up with up to 3 blocks. So even though the hardware resource for block level, you know, management says I can take up to 8 blocks, but because the blocks are big, okay, 256 each, you ended up only able to have 3 of them in each SMP. So this is not any rocket science. It's just that you have the various resource limitations. Whichever lower limitation that you hit first, you get limited, right? So, you know, it's just the same as any other kind of bottlenecks or resource limitations in the real world. Or you can easily think of another situation where you can have 128 threads per block, right? So, you know, if you have a rectangular, you know, a tile that somehow you design, which is different from the algorithm that we showed in class, and you could have easily have 8 by 16 tiles, and that gives you 128 threads. In this case, you will be able to have up to 6 blocks, because 768 divided by 128 is 6. And this 6 is still within the limit of 8 blocks, so you will end up running 6 of these 128 threads, thread blocks in the SMP, each SMP. And this is what we call the flexible resource allocation. And you're going to see this
several times in the next few lectures. You know what? The point is, it's not necessarily, you know what? The resources are not necessarily hard partitioned between the thread blocks. You could easily have a situation where you say, hey, I'm going to build an SMP so that I can have up to 8 blocks, and then I have a very rigid resource allocation, and say I have 768 threads that I can accommodate, so I would just divide it by 8, okay? I can divide it by 8, I could, and then so I will have a number of threads that I can accommodate in each thread block, right? Which is probably somewhere around 128 or something, right? And then, actually a little bit less than that. So, but then you can say you can have up to that number for each thread block, right? And that will be a rigid resource partition. And what that means is you cannot accommodate any thread blocks that are bigger than that number. So 256 would not be an option at that point. So, you know, what the design here allows is that you can actually have, you know, bigger thread blocks, and then you shrink the number of blocks that you can assign into the SMP, or you can have smaller thread blocks and you have more of those. And but this flexibility also adds to some interesting complexity in your programming, because now you have more possibilities. You know, in the more rigid partition, you will not need to test the 256 by 3, because that's not even a possibility. But in this architecture, you do have that flexibility, but then you need to actually go and check whether that possibility will give you better performance and better, you know, whatever, right? So this is a trade-off. The trade-off is you have more flexibility. As a result, you can have more control over how you use the resources. But it also adds to your work. You will need to actually think about how these different possibilities will end, you know, end up. So that's why, you know, many of us are working on tools and so on that gives you the option of not having to really worry about it and have the tools to automate some of these, you know, exploration, so that you don't need to simultaneously deal with all these different possibilities. Okay, so you're going to see some of that later on. Threads. That are, you know, so whether it's 256 threads per block and 3 blocks, or 128 threads per block, 6 blocks, once these blocks are assigned into the SMPs, okay, once they are assigned to SMPs, these threads will run concurrently in some way, okay? There's not enough hardware resources to really run 768 really at the same time, okay? But they are running in concurrent, you know, with each other in some way, and I'm going to show you, you know, in the next few slides. So essentially, the streaming multiprocessor will manage and schedule these threads for execution, so that it will best utilize the limited execution resources available on those SMs. Okay, so that's, you know, sort of the overview here. Any question before we move on?
Is it the same as the new GPUs?
Yes, the new GPU has, the 280 has exactly the same kind of policy and architecture.
And we still do 512 per block beyond?
I think the 512 block is still the same. So, okay. Yes.
So how is the caching laid out?
I mean,
at what level is all the
caching
shared?
Ah, wait. Sure. So there was... Yeah, I'll come back to that other question very soon. Okay, so let's go a little bit into, you know, what scheduling means in this architecture. So basically, scheduling means that you know, the threads will be, you know, will be kind of, you know, all these threads that are assigned into this streaming multiprocessor SAN will be all waiting around for execution. So they're all kind of, you know, they're all sitting around and, you know, looking for time to execute on the hardware, on the real execution hardware. So you have these 768 threads waiting to be executed on each SM, right? So the scheduler will pick a subset of those threads and execute, okay, at every clock cycle. Okay, in every clock cycle, a subset of those will be picked for execution. Make sense? And so each block is actually going to be chopped further into 32 thread warps. So let's say if you have 256 threads per in a block, then it will chop that into 32 thread warps. So if you divide 256 by 32, you get 8, right? So that 8, you have 8 warps, and each warp will have 32 threads. So this is, you know, nothing rocket science, but it's just that I need to take time to introduce them to you so that you build it up and so that you can be good at it, okay? There's really nothing too fancy about it. But if we didn't have to take the time to explain these things, you know what, oftentimes people get really confused further down the road. So if you have 128 threads per block, you will have 4 warps, okay? And if you have 64 threads per block, you will have, you know, 2 warps. If you have 32 threads per block, you have 1 warp. And if you have 16 threads per block, you will have 1 warp, okay? So you know what, that's another point. That is, if you go any further down below 32 threads, then your warp will have the threads that you define, but you will also have a bunch of things, you know, that you didn't define that will be wasting hardware resources. So defining a very, very small block under 32 will run inefficiently on these architectures, okay? It would, you know what, underutilize the hardware resources. So these warps are actually the scheduling units, okay? So far we have talked about two different concepts. One is what we call the work assignment. The thread blocks, okay? Thread blocks are the work assignment units into SMs, okay? Each time the SM has some space, one of the thread blocks gets assigned into the SM, okay? And then within the SM, the warps are the scheduling units. As soon as the blocks come in, they will be chopped up, okay, into these warps. And these warps are going to be the units that get swapped in and out of the execution units, so that you know, they will be the real execution unit, you know, execution work units. I saw a question. Yes, Eddie.
Well, you said if the warp had less than 32, it doesn't matter if you have resources.
Yeah.
Isn't it going to be true if you have any number of threads that are multiple?
Correct. Yeah, but the point is this. The point is, you know, you would, let's say if you have something like 125 per block, right? And these things are chopped up into 32, so one of them will be inefficient. Right, so you know, you will end up with one warp per block, but if you have but you still have quite a few others that are going to be efficient. But if you drop down below 32, every warp will be inefficient. All the blocks will be the same size. Okay, so once you remember, you know what, you have this invocation, right? So when you invoke the kernel, you're giving out the block that dimension, the grid dimensions and the block dimensions. So when you invoke the kernel, you already define the size of the blocks. And so that's uniform across all the, you know, all the entire kernel. Okay? I saw another question. Okay, good. So let me see which one I divided into 8 parts. Okay, so we covered this slide pretty well. So now, let's just go a little bit more into the scheduling. So what's really happening at runtime is that for G80, there are only 8 floating point execution units, okay, available at every clock cycle. So we have up to 768 threads, and they're all
wanting to be executed, but in every clock cycle, in reality, you only have 8 of those execution units that can produce results, right? So you need to somehow multiplex or somehow, you know, pick the subset, right, of these things onto the real execution units. And the way these things are done is that every time, you know what, at every clock cycle, there's what we call the zero overhead warp scheduling. So, you know, let's say, you know, if we put the full capacity of threads onto an SM, so that means we have 768 of those threads all waiting for execution, right? And divide by 32, that gives you 24, I believe, right? So 24 of those, you know, what, warps. So these warps are going to be all kind of, you know, lined up, okay? And you're going to ask a very important question. Are there any of these warps, okay, that are ready for execution? Which means that, you know, these warps already have, you know, the next instruction that you're going to execute in the warp already have its operands ready, you know, to go. Why would operands not be ready to go? Because if you have a memory access, okay, so let's say you go out to the global memory, and it takes hundreds of cycles. So during those hundreds of cycles, if there's another instruction, let's say a multiply instruction that needs to use the memory result, that operand is not going to be ready for hundreds of clock cycles. So that will be one of the reasons why the particular warp will not be ready for execution. So by having a large number of these warps, okay, and so hopefully you will have a bunch of these warps that are waiting for their memory accesses, right? But some of them will have already finished their memory accesses. So if you have enough of those, you will be able to spread them out so that there will always be some of them waiting, but there will be always some of them ready, okay? And so the zero overhead scheduling says you will, at every clock cycle, you know, conceptually at least, you will be able to go to the warps, okay, and use a hardware logic to figure out which are the ones that already have all the operands ready, okay? And then you will have a policy to pick from all those that are ready to go. And you will pick one of those warps into the hardware execution. Turns out that it's not exactly every clock cycle. Because remember, we have 32 threads per warp, and we only have 8 hardware execution units. So, you know what, without giving you too much hardware details, you know what, you can think about it sort of effectively as, well, every time a warp is picked, it will take 4 clock cycles to run the 32 threads, okay? To run one instruction out of all the 32 threads through the 8 function units, right? So the, you know, you have 32 of those threads, each one needs to have one instruction executed. And so first clock cycle, you take 8 of those threads and run one instruction, right? And then you take the next clock cycle, you take the next 8 threads, run them through, and then so on. So every time you pick a warp, you will probably keep the hardware busy for about 4 clock cycles, right? And then you will take, you know, go and take another warp, and you'll do the same thing. And, you know, if the current warp is ready to execute the next instruction, you may well have the current warp to execute, you know, the next instruction. So, you know, this is a little bit different from the traditional, you know, instruction execution that we usually teach in ECE, you know, 411. So, you know, that's why I'm spending a little bit of time. It's really the concept where, you know, in every thread, you do have a sequence of instructions you want to execute, right? So the real mode of execution in this kind of engine is, I'm going to keep track of the instruction I'm going to execute for every thread, okay, essentially for every warp. Because in every warp, you're going to have essentially the same instruction that the hardware will be executing across all the threads in the warp. So every time a warp is scheduled for execution, what that means is all the threads will have that same instruction run through the hardware execution unit, okay? And that's where the 4-clock cycle kind of thing comes through. And then after the 4-clock cycles, the hardware would do another reconsideration and then say, hey, you know, can I take the next instruction of the current warp and run them through the hardware, or I need to go to pick up another warp and then take, you know, take one instruction from another warp and run them through the hardware execution. So I should have triggered some question in your mind at this point. That is, you know what, if all the instructions in a warp, you know, if all the threads in a warp will run the same instructions through the hardware execution, what if they don't want to execute the same instruction? Right? What if you have an if then else, if you have something that would, you know what, that would lead each thread to execute, you know, to want to execute a different instruction? And that's called divergence, okay? And we're going to actually come back and talk about, you know, how the hardware handled that. It actually allows you to do it, but at reduced performance, okay? So, you know what, this is actually a little bit different from the CPU SIMD in the sense that, you know what, the hardware will actually transparently allow you to, you know, to the threads to actually diverge into different execution even within the warp, but it will cost you some performance. Okay, so we're going to come back to that point. So if you look at the slide 7, you know what, we actually, you know, kind of, you know, use a picture to illustrate, you know, how the warp scheduling kind of works. So, you know, effectively what happens is that you will have thread blocks. And, you know, in the picture, we're showing three thread blocks, TB1 through TB3. And, you know, we're showing a timing diagram of how these, you know, how these warps from the thread blocks execute. So let's say we also chopped up the thread blocks into warps. So you're seeing, you know, W1 of thread block 1, W1 of thread block 2. So each thread block will have, you know, essentially a thread block, you know, identifier and the kind of warp identifier. So the timing diagram shows the following. It shows that, you know, warp 1 of thread block 1 was able to execute, let's say, 6 instructions, okay? And it, you know, it executes, you know, let's say, you know, a memory load and so on. And then let's say the 7th instruction requires a memory you know, access result from one of the 6, right? So obviously it's not going to be there. You know what? It's going to take hundreds of clock cycles. So that instruction 7 will not be ready for execution. The hardware will see it. Okay, it's called scoreboarding. The hardware is actually going to detect the fact that the 7th instruction will not be ready for execution. So instead, the hardware will go to the pool and pick up one of the warps that is ready for execution. In this case, it's thread block 2 and warp 1. So it puts in the warp, and the warp executes for 2 instructions, and then realizes that it cannot continue into the 3rd instruction because, let's say, that instruction is waiting for pre-memory access. So then it immediately switched to another one. So you will go and look, you know, the hardware will look for another warp for execution. And this time you find thread block 3 and warp 1. It will execute for 2 instructions. So in the picture, we show that, you know what, there is a period of time where thread 1, warp 1 stalls. Means that it's actually going to go somewhere sitting in the SMP, you know, somewhere waiting for its memory accesses and so on. And that's the stall time for all the threads in that warp, okay? They're not gonna be eligible for execution during that time. And then thread block 2 also has some kind of stall time, and thread block 3 eventually will also have some stall time. And at every period, you know, every particular moment in time, you're going to actually see quite a few of these warps being stalled. And that's a good thing because you're overlapping the memory access delay of multiple memory requests, okay? So you're simultaneously asking the memory to give you data for multiple threads, right? And so that you can overlap the delays of all these accesses.
so that you don't end up waiting for one, and then you go and wait for another one, and you go wait for another one. At the same time, you simultaneously send all these things out, and then they will all hopefully come back roughly the same time. That's how you create more parallelism opportunities and tolerate these latencies better. So this is not all that different from some real world situation. Let's say if you drive a car to the mall, right, after class, and all your roommates go together, right? So all the four roommates go in one car, and so let's say you stop at the mall. Roommate one wants to buy some clothes. Roommate two wants to buy some shoes. Roommate three wants to buy some I don't go to the mall that often. So something, right? So you can have one of the two algorithms, right? You can have one algorithm where all the roommates sit in the car. You send out roommate one to buy the clothes, and after roommate one comes back into the car, you let roommate two go out and buy the shoes, right? And then after roommate two comes back, you send roommate three out and buy the belt, right? So that's sequential, right? That's very sequential, and all the latencies add up. And what the best approach is, you have all the three roommates go out, right? They all buy their things, and hopefully they all come back at the same time. So you cut the latency, the effective latency into 1/3, because all of them essentially ended up doing a latency. So that's why this kind of scheduling makes a lot of sense, okay? And so if you look into the schedule, you will start to understand the one thing that is, when you have a block, okay, when you have a block, you're going to actually have block chopped up into warps. So some of the warps may end up, let's say warp 2 of thread block 1 may not get into the execution until much, much later than, let's say, thread block 2 warp 1, right? So you may end up in a situation where thread block 2 may finish before thread block 1, because some of the warps in thread block 1 may not get to execution in time so that thread block 1 will finish before thread block 2. So that's why I kept saying you have to assume various, okay, all kinds of possible execution timings across thread blocks. Okay, this is yet another reason why you cannot assume that block 2 will always finish after block 1, or block 4 always will finish before after block 1. Anything can happen here, okay? And there are some policies and heuristics to minimize these kind of effects, but you really cannot assume that certain timing of finishing these thread blocks. Yes.
How would an if statement work?
Wait, because I actually have a whole lecture on it. Okay. Yes.
So just refer that there are many graphs that we put in the attempt. Is that imply that we have one choice that we can put 768 threads in the SM, and we also have the choice to break that into many graphs. So it will be possible. So the okay. Best choice for us would be to break that into as many graphs as possible.
Wait.
So we can break
them. Yeah. Wait. So there are trade-offs. So the question is now that we know, right, there are all these possible ways of doing what is the higher level policy, or how do you decide? Do we use big blocks with small smaller number of blocks, or use small blocks with large number of blocks, right? So let's go through this exercise a little bit, and then I'll explain in general how people make that decision. So let's say for matrix multiplication using multiple blocks, should I use 8 by 8? Should I use 16 by 16? Should I use 32 by 32? At a very high level, your matrix multiplication is going to be, let's say, whatever you need to do is not affected by any of these decisions, right? It's the application, right? So if you need to do a 1K by 1K matrix multiplication, you need to have 1K by 1K. So it doesn't really, that is an application level mandate, right? You need to support a particular size matrix multiplication. So this is really just underneath that, right? So given a, you know, a size that you need to multiply, you know, should I use these 8 by k, 8 tiles, 16 by 16 tiles, or 32 by 32 tiles? And that defines the number of threads in each block. Make sense, right? So, but if you use larger blocks, you'll end up with smaller number of blocks to do the same 1k by 1k matrix multiplication. So the in the end, the total number of threads will be the same because that's, you know, what the application wants. So for 8 by 8, we will have 64 threads per block. And since each SM can take up to 768 threads, we could potentially, you know, if you divide 768 by 64, we have enough threads to have to accommodate 12 blocks. But the hardware had a limitation, right? The hardware can only accommodate 8 blocks. So you get limited at the block level. So if you choose 8 by 8, you will end up with only 512 threads executing in that in each SM. So you will be wasting about one-third of your thread level resources. Okay, you will be wasting that. So you will end up with less parallelism than, you know, you can theoretically have in the SM. If you have, so let's say, okay, now let me, you know, boost it up a little bit. You know, so let me get, you know, a little bit more threads per block. So let's say we do a 16 by 16. And now we have 256 threads per block. And so now since we have, you know, we can take up to 768 threads, we ended up with 3 thread blocks, which is within the limit of the 8 blocks that we can put into the thread block. Great. So this way we fully utilize the thread level resources in a, you know, in the SM. Okay, so that's a good, that in that sense it's a good pick. They say, okay, since it's getting better, why don't I go one more level, right? So, you know, I would say, let's try to do 32 by 32. But 32 by 32 will require 1,024 threads per block. And that exceeds the number of threads, right, that you can put into a SN. So you cannot even have one block, and that's bad, okay? When the blocks are too big, that's very bad. So essentially, you will not execute correctly on the SMs. Depends on the version of the chip you have, depending on the SDK and so on. And you may have unpredictable behavior. So you may, you know, in some cases, you may even appear to execute, but it doesn't give you the correct results. But in some cases, it should tell you that you cannot execute, okay? So what's the current situation?
I think ever since really early versions, it'll always just give you an error. But since it's a non-blocking kernel launch, you have to call a specific function to
find out,
catch the error.
Yeah, but if you don't catch the error, it may appear that it has run, but you don't have any results.
Yeah,
right?
If you never check to see whether it was an error, you have no idea whether or not there was an error.
Yeah, so it's not something that will be in your face and say, I didn't run. You have to check for it. Yes? Yeah.
If we were to look at a larger granularity, kernel by kernel granularity, who does support the overlapping of kernel to kernel computation on a single GPU? Or is that too early?
In fact, it's not too early, but you know what? It's actually one of those topics that you know what? We keep talking to NVIDIA and then trying to get a better handle on these things. So we may have something, you know, better to say, but. For most of the programming that we use today, it's just one kernel after another kernel, and you know what, there is a way for the hardware to support it, but you know what, it's not clear how it's best can be best exposed to the programming model.
Yeah. Okay. But let me give you a little more details. I'm trying to think because I have a couple hardware generations in my head. I'm reasonably certain that up to the current generation, the device can only issue blocks from a particular kernel at a time without relatively massive overheads, more or less amounting to a context switch. So in that context, it's possible that you can start issuing blocks from a subsequent kernel before the previous kernel is completely finished, if you know that there aren't going to be dependencies in between the two using the streaming API. Beyond that, right now there isn't any support for overlapping kernels.
Yeah, but there is actually a plan, you know, a kind of an effort trying to enable that. It's just that, you know, it will take a while to be reflected in the programming model. So there was a question actually I was going to answer later, and you know what, I actually forgot what the question was. So remember, there was a question that I said in a few slides I'll be able to better answer the question. Yes. Ah, okay. So the question was, you know, well, what if you have more threads than you can execute in the SMB? So, you know what, that there's a reason why I told you that, you know, I'll be able to better answer it, you know, after a couple of slides. So let's talk about, you know what, so that's the basic sort of some of the basic concepts of threading and scheduling, blocks, warps, and so on. And that should be sufficient for you to do a good job in your MP1. Okay, you know, you should have all the basic concepts that you need for MP1. And so let's go a little bit deeper into, you know, some of the things that you will be using soon, you know, in the next couple of MPs. So, you know what, let's talk a little bit more details of these, you know, application interface, essentially, you know, runtime library features. So, you're going to see this application programming interface again and again in most of these, you know, programming courses. And you know what, it's kind of in the very early days, you know what, people just call these things libraries and so on. But it turns out that you know what, they're a little bit more than libraries, because they usually support some data structures and data types, okay, that are convenient for programmers to use in a particular application, you know, area. So you know what, that's why, you know, people eventually started to call these things application programming interface, meaning that, you know what, these things altogether provide a sort of a higher level, more logical way of manipulating some data structures and some data objects in these applications that make the programmer's life easier. Okay. So the API is really an extension to the C programming language, and it consists of really, you know what, two main things. One is language extension, okay, and you know what, that's what I was talking about. You know, you have some, you know, data types and, you know, some things that would, you know, to allow the portions of the code for execution on the device to be, you know, more easily written. And then another one is really the runtime library, and it's split into three parts. One is a common component, which means that the library is actually usable by both the host code and the device code, okay? So the same library can be used and called from both, you know, CPU and the GPU, right? And the second one is the host component. And these are the additional library functions on the host that you can execute on the host to be able to better control, manage the device, okay, or to do the data transfer and access and so on. And then you have a device component that really provides device-specific services, or in some functions that can be executed much more efficiently on the device, okay? And but they are not going to be nearly as efficient on the host, so they actually isolated some of these functions and make them into device-only functions so that people don't accidentally try to call these functions on the host code, okay? So, you know, we're going to actually give you a little bit, you know, more details on these categories. So let's first talk about the language extensions. One of the most obvious language extension that you have been seeing, you know, starting MP1 is this DIM3, right? It's really, you know what, just, you know, kind of a C++ kind of data declaration, static data declaration. It's really a you know, three element data structure, okay, X, Y, Z, you know what, the three dimensions. And why is it, you know what, it's actually mostly, you know what, used as the, you know, to define the indices and multi-dimensional indices and dimension sizes of the threads or data structures. So you know what, you can have, you know what, the first one, you know, is a building variable. This grid bin, G-R-I-D-B-I-N, this is a building variable that you can, you know, can use to actually, you know, define the number of number of blocks in each dimension of the grid. Actually, is it a building variable, grid bin?
Yeah.
Right? It is, right? You don't have to declare it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Okay. Somehow
in the device code.
Yeah, in the device code. So remember, the grids are currently two dimension, right? So each grid can currently only has X and Y dimension of blocks. So you know what, the Z dimension is not used at this point. Block. So there, then for each block, there is a block dimension variable. It's also a built-in variable. And the dimensions of, you know, it defines the dimensions of a block in terms of threads. And each block, remember, can be one, two, or three dimensions. So it's up to you to give those numbers to each dimension to define, right? You know, how many you want. If you don't want a particular dimension, put the one in there. Right, so that, you know, essentially there's no, put a one in there, that means that there's no, you're not using that dimension. So, you know what, then the two important, so these two are in general used for kernel invocation, okay? And the other two, block ID, index and thread index variables, are the ones that you use within the thread, within the kernel, right? For each thread to access the appropriate portion of the data structure, right? And we show the usage of the block ID X, Y, and the thread ID index X, Y in the matrix multiplication code. And these are all built-in variables. That means that you don't need to declare them, and you know what, you can just go ahead and use them. There's common runtime components, mostly. You know, the most often ones that you're going to be using are the mathematical functions. And there are a whole wealth of these mathematical functions that you can use both on the CPU and on the GPU. So that's why this is a common, common component. So you can have the power function square root and, you know, complex the types and, you know, all these things and, you know, exponential functions, log functions, sine, cosine, transcendental functions, ceiling, floor, truncation, round, all that stuff. So whenever you run one of these functions on the host, typically these functions are going to be directed to the host library. Okay, Intel has a, you know, a library, and then, you know, Linux, you know, GCC has a library, and so on. So whatever library you have available and you're linking into this will likely be the one that be using, okay? And you know, so these functions are supported only for scalar types, not the vector types. So you cannot send in those, you know, DIM3 kind of stuff into these libraries. You know, send just a scalar variable, okay, into these functions. So you know, many of these functions will be double precision when you call it on the host. If you really want a single precision call, you need to look at the host menu and make sure that you call the single precision version. And they usually tell you how you can specify, dictate that you call the single precision version. Now, there is a device component version of some of these functions, okay? So you know, like the power function, like the log 2, log 10, like the sine, cosine, tangent, like the exponent, like exponential. You know, these are actually functions that are implemented in real hardware. Okay, they are really implemented in hardware. You know, on the GPUs today. And these things are very, very fast. They're, you know what, they're really, you know, at least 5 times or more faster, okay, than the host versions, or than the, you know, the software versions running on the GPU too. So on the other hand, some of these functions, because of the hardware implementation, they may have a small number of digits less, or less accuracy than the full function. So you will need to make sure that your application can tolerate some of these reduced accuracies, okay? And I'm going to actually have a whole lecture on, you know, accuracies and how to read the specification and so on, you know, in a few lectures. So in many applications, such as medical imaging, they use a lot of sines and cosines. Okay, in some of the quantum chemistry, you know, calculation and so on, they also use some of these things, and you know, astrophysics. And this is known to be a great source of speed up in addition to parallelism. Usually you will have, you know, a few times of speed up just by using these functions, and then you, you know, you multiply that with your parallelism. So it's something that, you know, you will end up, you should end up using, you know, as long as the, you know, you can live with the accuracy. And then, you know, there is a host runtime component that provides these functions that, you know, does device management. And especially, you know, when you have multiple devices, multiple GPUs, and, you know, we're going to actually going to try to add a lecture on how you can use multiple GPUs this semester. John Stone and I are kind of working on a new lecture. And then, you know, you have a memory management. You know, remember those, you know, CUDA malloc, right? You know, all that stuff, right? So those are the kind of, you know, code that you call from the host and allocate space in the device memory, in device global memory. And what John alluded to a little bit earlier, error handling. You know, you're going to, you know, there are situations where you're going to have to, you know, be proactive and check for errors. And, you know, because of, you know, some of the performance considerations, you know, John alluded to this, but I'll have to come back and give you a little bit more detail later, which is, you know, asynchronous kernel, you know, invocation and so on. They really give you a better handle of performance. But what that means is, unless you explicitly go and check for errors, you're not going to get report. So that means that you, when you write code and so on, you will need to explicitly check for errors if you care about it. And initialize the first time, you know, a runtime function is called, and then, you know, a host thread can invoke, you know, device code only on, you know, only on one device. So what this means is that if you have multiple GPUs, you are going to have to use multiple Unix threads or Linux P threads, and each thread will be essentially working with one GPU so that you can have multiple GPUs going. Okay? So here is some word, you know, after this slide, I will be able to answer one of the questions that Xiaolong was asking. So, you know what, there is a device runtime component that is, you know, probably the most important device runtime component, you know, that you're going to use in, through the semester, which is sync thread. It's __ sync threads. This sync threads will synchronize all the threads in a block. Okay, so let's say if you have, you know, 250 threads in a block, this call will make sure that all the 256 threads all have made that call, okay? And they will wait for each other until all the 256 of those have reached that point before any of them will be allowed to proceed any further. This is typically called barrier synchronization. Most of you are probably familiar with the concept, but, you know, just to make sure that everyone's on the same page, barrier synchronization is perhaps the most used synchronization method that, you know, human beings use to make sure that we don't cause some very bad effects to individuals. And let me, whenever we have a large number of people in, you know, in activities, the various synchronization tend to be the most important method for us to do synchronization. So let me give you one example. How many of you have participated in bus tours? Should be quite a few. So, you know, let's say you have a bus that goes to a tour, you know, kind of a sightseeing area, right? And the bus driver is going to use the microphone and say it three times, okay? We're going to leave in 40 minutes, right? And in 40 minutes, everyone back on the bus, right? And we're going to go to the next destination, right? So, you know what, then, you know what, everyone take the camera, the, you know, the whatever, and go to, you know, go and haggle for lower price souvenirs and all that stuff. So then, after 40 minutes, guess what happens? Less than half of the people will be back, right? So, you know, you have half of the people back, and the bus driver will start to look around, and then, you know, he or she will count the number of people. Another 5 minutes, you know, another half of the half will come back, right? And then, you know, the bus driver started to get a little bit nervous, and then, you know, I said, okay, you know what, so you start to look around a little bit. And eventually the bus driver was saying, well, have a reasonable belief that everyone has got on the bus. But before the bus driver drives away, guess what he does? Count the number of people one more time. Okay? Otherwise, you will have a situation where one, right? The bus driver will turn back at some point and then say, you know, look for a lost person, right? So that's barrier synchronization, okay? Until everyone is accounted for on that bus. It doesn't matter that you said 40 minutes, okay? 40 minutes is just advice, okay? You know, in any part of the world, you know, 40 minutes is just advice. You know, there's some people who are going to be deep into, you know, negotiating a, you know, $50,000 statue or something that will have to be smuggled out of the country or something, you know, putting on all the custom films or all the smuggling, you know, you know, arrangements whatsoever, okay? Oh, I'm being recorded. So, you know what? You know what? So barrier synchronization is exactly designed for that. Timing cannot be guaranteed in these kind of executions. Remember, each thread block is going to be chopped into these what? Warps, right? And these warps will have their individual fates, okay? They're going to be executing, you know, in different times and so on. So, you know, the only way to make sure that all the threads in a thread block have all completed until a certain point before you move on to the next destination, you need to do a sync thread, okay? Now, you cannot do sync threads to synchronize threads across blocks, okay? There's no such capability, right, with this sync thread call. So this goes back to what Xiaolong was asking. You know what, if you, you know what, given the fact that you can have 768 threads, should I use, okay, should I use, you know, 250, you know, 16 by 16 or 8 by 8, should I use, you know, as many threads as possible in a thread block, or should I use as few thread, you know, threads in a thread block, but many thread blocks, up to 8 thread blocks per SM? This actually is one of the considerations. If you have an application that requires barrier synchronization as part of your, you know, let's say, you know, your functionality, then you need to be aware that, you know, having as many of them as possible allows you to have an efficient way of synchronizing as many threads as possible, so that you only need to resort to a heavier duty synchronization method across thread blocks once in a while. So that allows you, that essentially would steer you towards using as many threads as possible in a thread block. However, you also have a consideration where if you do a barrier synchronization across a large number of threads in a block, that also means that you're going to have fewer and fewer and fewer threads executing within the block, because more and more people are coming back to the bus. They're all going to be sitting on the bus, okay? So it's equivalent to whether you use a big bus and then you do a huge barrier synchronization and, you know, make sure that all the 80 people are, you know, are on the bus. Or maybe you can just actually run 4 small buses, and each bus will only need to synchronize on 20 of these people. So some of the, you know, the tourists, you know, some of the buses may be able to go ahead and leave because all the 20 people are already on the bus, right? So you get more flexibility that way. So that's one of the, you know, considerations. And oftentimes, you know what, the synchronization, you know what, considerations will push you towards some kind of middle point somewhere, you know, not the biggest one, not the smallest one. Nick, thank you. Yeah. So you just, it's a function call. It's in the code. You say, oh, you know what? Remember, kernels are per thread code, right? So each thread will be doing activity 1, activity 2, activity 3. If you say, I want to make sure that all my fellow threads have finished activity 1 before I can do activity 2, you do a function call in between. You call the sync threads. Yes. Okay, John.
I think, just to clarify, were you asking how you like create and initialize barriers and specify? Like, you don't really. So each function call to sync threads that you put in the code corresponds to a separate barrier. So every time you put in sync threads, it's implicitly saying the barrier is initialized so that all threads in the block have to hit that barrier, and each textual sync threads that you put in there corresponds to a different barrier.
Good. In fact, that's, you know, that's the kind of leads well into the next point. The point is, you know, if you have an if then else, okay, if then else in the code, right? And let's say you have a sync thread on the then part and a sync thread on the else part. They're really different barriers. And it's only allowed if you know for sure that all the threads will be involved in a block, will actually take either they will all take the left or they all take the right. You cannot have a situation where you try to say, oh, half of the blocks will take the left and half of the block will take the right, and they're both synchronizations, right? So you know what, they will eventually all get together. They're different barriers. So you will have half of them waiting here and half of them waiting there, and the bus will never leave. Okay? I'm sorry?
At this point, you might put a student.
Yeah, exactly. Okay? Good. So that's, you know what, that's what we need to say about, you know what, the thread blocks and then some of the APIs to make sure that you can, you know, you can do the MPs. So that leads into the, you know what, the next 5-10 minutes. You know, we wanted to allocate a little bit of time for you to ask questions to clarify MPs and so on. And we already have one question, you know, that I should clarify. So one of you asked whether, you know, you're going to be doing square matrix or rectangular matrix, right? So the answer is you should try to do as general a matrix multiplication as possible, but we're going to only test the square matrix case. How does that sound? Right? John, any supplements?
Not in particular. In general, if you have questions, rather than emailing either one of us, try and post the question on the web board so that we don't get multiple copies of emails and have to respond with the same answer multiple times.
Okay, so let me open the floor and then, you know what, any additional questions about MP1, you know, if you wonder how you should get started, you know, where's the assignment, whatever, right? You know what, so this is the time to ask so that you can quickly start. We really hope that you will all start your MP1, right? You know what, you have started already, and you know what, if you haven't, you really should start now. Okay. Any other questions? NCSA accounts, anything? How many of you are still waiting for your account paperwork? Yeah, so we should have most of them here. Everyone who has signed up for the class before January 22nd or something should have all their paperwork. Otherwise, it's a mistake. And I think there are 3 of you who added very recently. I'm going to go and bribe the NCSA allocations team so that we can get those assignments done. So, you know what, remember, you know, I had, you know what, remember this, you know what, next time you run into NCSA staff, be very nice to them, you know, kind of thing. Any other questions? If not, good luck with MP1, okay?
Come see me for your paperwork, for passwords.